fans in here? That's it. Yes. Georgia Bulldogs.
Oh,
how many going to the game? No hands. Well, I tell you what, we want to make sure they spend some money in our town, right? Right. Well, good morning. We're getting ready to get started with the affordable housing panel. I am so excited. I see a lot of faces that have been with us from the beginning, and I also see some new faces this morning. And we have had an in-depth discussion on affordable housing. My co-chair and I have enjoyed convening after the meetings, as well as getting an opportunity to see how we can continue and not just talk about what the issues are. You know, we were charged by our president and Councilman Boylan and Salem to make sure that not only we talk, but we develop a plan, legislation. Can't say we can pay for everything, but I think what we can do is have a conversation that is useful for not only now, maybe taking care of the low-hanging fruit, and maybe plan for the future in terms of enhancement and implementation. So we're going to get started, and we're going to go around the panel and do an introduction, and we're going to jump right in. Is that okay with y'all? Yes. Ooh, wait a minute. Y'all need some coffee or something? What's going on? Okay, so we're going to start from my left, and we're going to go around and introduce yourselves.
Marcus Floyd, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Noel Cumber, Northeast Florida Regional Council.
Alex Sifakis, KWB.
Kalina Shirley, BBIF.
Kalina Shirley, BBIF.
Michael Boylan, District 6. And Madam Chair, if I have a moment after we finish the introductions, I'd love a couple comments.
David Jaffe, University of North Florida.
Tasha Chester, Rapid Rehousing for Change in Homelessness and Family Promise of Jacksonville.
I'm sorry. Use your mics. Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll
use our mic. Make sure the green light's on.
Make sure. So you turn it on in the back.
No, they're on. You just have to push the button.
Yours wasn't on.
Okay.
There you go. You see that green light?
Tasha Chester, can you
hear me? Well, I have no light at all. It might need a battery or whatever.
We'll share this.
Okay, we'll share. All right. So I think we're ready to get started. We have a lot of conversation, and I'm excited. My co-chair and I have had conversation with Councilwoman this past week, Renee Flowers, and we was hoping that we could get her here today, but if not, they're doing some amazing things in Pinellas County, and so I hope we have an opportunity to get her here and have a conversation about what they're doing. We may be able to use some of the best practices that they're doing down there. But we're going to go ahead and get started and let Dr. Jaffe give us any updates from last week and any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm not going to say much now because we have a panel. I'd like to get started with that. But later on the agenda, as you see, there is it says a SWAT analysis. I'm not sure what that is. It's a SWAT analysis. And we distributed the SWAT diagram to people a couple weeks ago, and we got your feedback. So I am going to distribute that. And I have included in the document that I'm going to be distributing the feedback that we received from the people who are here, so you can look it over. I also will include there on that document a list of some of the policy implications of the conversations we've had and the material and information we've received from the presenters. And so you can look over some of those policy implications, potential policy recommendations as well. And then I'm hoping we can have an open discussion and get your reaction to what we have found from the SWOT analysis and whether you believe some of those policy recommendations are viable and whether they can be put forward as recommendations to the City Council. So that's what we'll be doing after we have our three presenters.
Okay. I also like for Councilman Boylan to speak, and then after him, maybe an update from the Regional Council, and then we'll jump into our program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to update. As you know, we had a midterm committee meeting of the three working groups on last Thursday. It was an opportunity for us to see where the work of each of the committees intersects, and also an opportunity for the co-chairs from the other groups to be here about what's happening in this particular committee work, as well as in the other two. I was very pleased, as I've said all along, about how what great progress we're making and the work that's being done here. Someone was asking me yesterday, how do you feel about where it's going? And I said, you know, the success is really the people in the room. You know, having all of you here participating and engaging and showing us and telling us what we need to do. And in many respects, this, in my mind, is really the role of government in the process, is to use the people who work in the fields to tell us what we need to do in terms of impacting policy, structure, and finance and support. I did want to mention, and I think it's worth the time for particularly all those in this group, yesterday at the homelessness working group, there was a presentation by Catherine Vassell, the executive director of Partners for Home in Atlanta. And what she spoke about was very, not only is it focused on the homeless and affordable housing issue, but also focused on, you know, attainable housing opportunities and what they're doing in Atlanta. And I suggest you take a few minutes to watch that presentation as well as the one from Miami and Minneapolis as well. It's this kind of path that we're going on that I'm so very pleased about, and I'm looking forward to it. And I want to also reaffirm very quickly, if I may, Madam Co-Chairs, please, just to affirm, at the end of the day, we are going to put together a comprehensive report that will include all your recommendations, because I think we need to codify in document form what you all think needs to be done. We as a committee, the working group co-chairs, or actually particularly the city council members who are in a position to offer bills and ordinances, introduce them to the council, are not going to be doing it as a committee. I think what's going to happen, and my hope is, that there will be individual council members who step forward on a particular recommendation and move it forward as it should be done. And that will be an opportunity for all of us to really dig in. So we've got a recommendation that says we want to give everybody $1 million. And the opportunity is, I'll introduce that bill because it would be very, very popular. Maybe not with my Republican friends so much. But the fact of the matter is, it will be an opportunity for all of us then to really dig in into the committee process, looking at how viable that particular recommendation is in, number one, addressing the issues that we are looking to address, and number two, how practical it is in terms of implementation and that sort of thing. So we did talk about that last week as part of our midterm meeting, is what are some of the criteria that we should apply as the recommendations come over from these various working groups. I hope that's helpful. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Y'all can hear me okay through the mic? Is that better?
I don't think it's working.
There it goes. And I can talk real loud, but I know we need to record it. So the Regional Council is very happy to be here in support of speaking for Marcus Lloyd and myself. Part of that support includes that we take notes. We also compare it to the Legislative Services notes to make sure any critical issues are not missed, or highlight things to the special committee that we think just need to be highlighted in general. So I'm also speaking on behalf of Beth Payne, our CEO, who could not be here. We're very happy to support. As Councilman Boylan had mentioned, with getting to a final report, the intended goal is the mid-December, end of December timeframe, and that's also part of our support. So we're just happy to be here, to help support everything.
Thank you all so much. We're now getting ready to start our panel discussions, and we're going to start with Kalina Shirley. She will introduce herself and share the work, the body of work that she has done in our community. Thank you so much.
Good morning. My name is Kalina Shirley. I'm the North Florida Regional Director with BBIF, which stands for Black Business Investment Fund. We're a CDFI, which stands for Community Development Financial Institution. We're a 35-year organization out of Central Florida that headquartered here in Jacksonville in 2019 when I was able to open the market here. My background is very, very much so tied to this subject matter. Sorry if you couldn't hear me. Do I need to restart?
No.
Okay. As I am a product of affordable housing, and only here because of the sacrifices that were made by my mom to ensure that our family had a home, that we weren't in a disadvantaged community that we were brought up in, and that we were able to get into a home where she knew that we were safe and secure. And so that being my start, I've brought that to every lane that I've been in as a passion to see how I can always be an advocate for affordable housing and support affordable housing in all that I do. And so having a background in government, I was a planner for 10 years for the city of Winter Park. I was also the housing operations manager here at the city of Jacksonville, and then the housing affordable housing administrator prior to going to BBIF in 2014. And so this space is one that is, like I said, near and dear to my heart. And what we've been doing with BBIF is trying to really see from a capital standpoint how we can be impactful in not just growing businesses, but impacting community. And what we know to be true is that housing is by far the greatest wealth builder in America, period. And unfortunately, in urban communities and African-American communities, that access to that wealth building has been a challenge to be able to have and hold, and has been what has allowed our businesses to lag behind, as well as our communities, in that we do not have the preponderance of home ownership that is needed to grow and advance community as a whole. And so what we wanted to do is say, what is the way that a financial institution who's not in the housing building lane, how can we be impactful? How can we support the community as it looks to expand and grow housing as well as to redevelop community? And we've done that by way of creating our contractor assistance program. What we have pledged to do and have been able to do here in Jacksonville, and I would be remiss not to acknowledge the funder that's allowed us to be in this space, which is the Northeast Florida Community Foundation, that gave us the seed money to be able to launch this program here in Jacksonville and support. At this time, we have 11 GCs or trades minority folks in our program that we're supporting through technical assistance. And I'll get into kind of how we do that. But we were able to do that through community support. And it's so important to understand the need for cross collaboration and partnership to make this happen. But what we are doing is we're supporting the GCs and the developers that have a heart for community and that are wanting to be impactful in redeveloping the community by giving them a means to access to technical assistance, as well as making sure their businesses are staged in a way that they can grow and have the capacity to grow to be impactful. And so I'll start with this presentation here. So as I stated, with BBIF, our mission is to develop and promote black and minority-owned enterprises through education, training, loans and investments, and other activities that we use to aggressively promote an atmosphere conducive to their development. And in whole, what we're saying is we're hyper-intentional about us having a focus on African-American-owned businesses. As a CDFI, we are judged as to how we are able to support our target market, and we specifically want to be intentional about making our target market black-owned businesses, as black-owned businesses have had the biggest disparities in accessing capital, as well as not having that base foundation of support and training around growing sustainable long-term businesses. While that is our target market, we do not discriminate in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and we are open to supporting all businesses in the community. We just our beacon call is to that community that has had challenges in this financial sector. Some of our core services at BBIF include access to capital, as well as the training that I spoke of in helping to establish strategic partnerships to address the needs of African-American-owned small businesses. We also have monthly CEO roundtables where we are directly engaged and involved with small businesses to ensure that we're staying engaged with them so that when they do access capital,
that is done in a way that is impacting their bottom line, so that they're knowing and have some guidance in using that access to capital. I have a saying that debt can take you out of business, just like not having access to capital can. And so we are very intentional about our technical assistance and making sure that we're supporting those businesses in that space. So our contractor assistance program, we'll go into just here really quickly. So some of our CAP goals, I'm having a little trouble with the timing of the projector here.
She's having problems
with the clicker. Is it easier for me just to say next slide? I think there's a little delay here.
You want me to do next slide? I can.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So our CAP program in a whole is really around having a full surface effort at supporting the GC or the tradesperson that is in this space through making sure they have direct access to mentoring, making sure they have access to adequate funding, as well as making sure that they have the technical assistance resources to grow their business. And so this full approach also includes giving them access, if needed, to accounting professionals or lawyers or additional or primes that they can get protege type of assistance from as they grow their small businesses. Why we chose to focus on the GCs and the contractors is that from our experience in working in the community, we know that the CDCs, the CHOTOs that are here in the community to do the development oftentimes don't have the internal capacity to really be as impactful as they would like to be in the community and take on the number of projects that they really need to take on to be able to show that impact. And a lot of times, not having that in-house construction knowledge or professionals is really limiting their ability to really advance and grow their models to be impactful. And so our approach was that if we can build a workforce of GCs, a workforce of contractors that are primed, that are supported, and are able to provide assistance to the CDCs and the CHOTOs, collectively, we can get more done, we can help them advance to get to more projects, and then they can do what they do best from a community service standpoint while being able to rely on the contractors that have come through our program to assist them in their development needs. And so it really was an angle of how do we take that burden, how do we take that stress out of that equation so that we have a resource where we can't be directly the developer or we can't assign, you know, properties and things like that that a county or a city can. We can't provide the workforce that can support that. So some of the key challenges, as we started the program, we did a robust survey of contractors as well as community providers to really understand what are some of the challenges that they have. Some of the main challenges that they ran into was needing assistance with proposals and bids, not really being a part of city processes. It's often a challenge to know how to go into an RFP process and respond accordingly. And so we directly help them navigate through local government procurement processes, whether that be in partnership with a nonprofit or if they're trying to go into programs like a JSET program and go after projects themselves, we'll give them guidance and assistance. We also assist them in obtaining bonding insurance so that they are shored up to be able to go through local government processes or to be able to be successful in that space where bonding is needed. We provide them a number of resources around financial management. What we know to be true for contractors specifically is that they're really great with what they do from a construction side. And a lot of times the back side of the house, the business side of the house, is where they're needing true assistance or needing to really have some foundational support in that space. And so that's where we provide that direct financial management assistance and helping them make sure that they're running the business while they're doing the great work that they're doing. Additionally, we pair them with Prime so that it can get some additional help instead of just competing against crimes. How do we pair them? How do we create a process of networking, a protege program where they can grow to be into that prime space instead of being a small guy trying to go after large projects? How do we set up an environment where we can maybe get them on teams and then grow them? And so we've done that bridge building to try and help locate primes that can facilitate them moving into larger spaces. And then last but not least, but happens to be the most important piece, is access to capital. And that's really where this conversation segues to this whole affordable housing conversation. As you may know, that in order to get access to capital, especially on larger levels, you need some type of collateral. There is not a major bank or anyone else that is going to allow you to come in and secure a loan without some level of collateral to do that. And in many cases, our small businesses don't own their homes. And that becomes one of the biggest gaps in them being able to access financing, is not having either the equity from a home or being able to have a home to shore up the capital they're accessing, so they don't get access, especially to those larger pieces of funding if it's not for a CDFI or someone who's able to kind of stand in the gap for that need. And so one of the biggest things that we, our mission to do, is provide access to capital in a way that's outside of the traditional model. As a CDFI, instead of just checking the underwriting box and saying how you're not able to be in a position to access capital because the risk is too great, we look for every way possible to be able to support that lending arm. And that also includes being able to look at the proficiency of the business and being able to make adjustments in the capital space. But just as the community needs affordable housing to stabilize the community, small businesses need affordable housing to be able to have a mechanism to stabilize small businesses. An additional way that we impact the access to capital space, my personal experience being in local government and knowing contractors that have come through local government processes, a lot of time when you're trying to go through a bid process, you have to show the financial means to be able to take on that project. That means those dollars have to be in your coffers to show that you have the capacity to take on those projects. And that just is not the case a lot of times, especially for African-American-owned businesses. They're usually cash-strapped and don't have that preponderance of funding that's sitting aside. And then there's challenges with getting lines of credit. And so we said, well, how can we be impactful? How can we create something that directly deals with this issue? And we came up with our contract financing loan fund. This allows a contractor that's going through specifically and especially local government processes to be able to use that contract with the local government as collateral. So they're not, if they don't have a home or they're not able to secure the line of credit in advance, we can provide a temporary line of credit to allow them to go through an RFP process for that amount that they're bidding on. And then once they obtain that contract becomes the collateral for that loan. They're able to then get a portion of that loan fronted up front so they can start the project and then know that they have the funding to be able to take through that project in entirety and complete that project without having to rob one project funding to another, pay Peter to pay Paul to get through projects, which is often how they eat themselves or process themselves out of the profit, as well as just those business practices are not secure practices to help them be sustainable long term. And so this is one of the ways that we have seen success in being able to support the contractors that are teaming up to go through, whether it be the housing programs here in the city of Jacksonville or the JSET programs, to be able to provide them a mechanism to get into these processes and have the adequate funding to be able to perform. And so I didn't do too long of a presentation. I know we have several other people that are presenting, but we just want to provide this as a means to how we can be a partner and supportive in this space in trying to grow our community of contractors that can be accessible and available to be impactful in the affordable housing space and how we can be a part of building community. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kalina. And what we'll do is have questions at the end. I will say I really appreciate that presentation because it's kind of like the end of the day on the way home and how we can get developers to work with the primes to make sure that affordable housing is available in communities and our neighborhoods, especially in underserved communities as well. Our next panelists don't need an introduction, but I'm going to let him introduce himself. Is Alex Savakas. Alex, if you could go ahead and get started as well and introduce yourself.
I'll do. I'm going to stand up. I need to move around when I speak. Can you guys hear me? Councilwoman Pittman, I really appreciate you putting this all together and appreciate you inviting me here to speak. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to talk a little bit about JWB. I think there is some misconceptions in the market on what we do, and then talk a lot about what I see as some problems and then solutions to the affordable housing crisis here in Jacksonville. So JWB was founded in 2006 by myself and my business partner, Greg Cohen, who's a high school and college buddy slash roommate. This is actually us at our first real estate seminar. My wife would kill me if I told her I was showing this picture on here. I also apologize. I might not be on my A game today. I have a three-week-old at home, and I'm running off about 3 hours of sleep every night. So he's awesome, much easier than the other two, but still, newborn. So had no prior real estate experience. I went to University of Florida. My mom is a teacher. My dad is a cook. And we went to a real estate seminar. Literally, it was a Robin Thompson seminar. You can see the poster in the background and it worked. We started buying and selling and flipping houses. We were able to survive the Great Recession. Because we paid all of our lenders back. We took a lot of those losses personally. And then we started growing the business exponentially in 2010 when most other real estate investors had fallen out of the market and you were able to buy properties for not very much money. So we have a huge focus on the community, on our company culture and the community. We've got, 10 core values, you're growing, you're dying, people first. Be a great teammate. And then we really focus on the community, which might come as a surprise to a lot of people in here from what some of the comments that I've heard, which is really disheartening to us because we really view ourselves as a partner in providing a solution to the affordable housing crisis. And that's who we want to be. And really, it's been kind of eye-opening seeing all the different perspectives on affordable housing and what the solutions are. But just to give you some examples, so I don't know if a lot of you are familiar with the Historic East Side and the Historic East Side CDC run by Suzanne Pickett. So they started a cultural center. Their cultural center is actually in a building that we own that we're leasing to them for $1 a year. Also, all the parking lots over on the east side that they're parking are our parking lots. So right now, Florida, Georgia, they have control of all of our parking lots, and the East Side CDC is getting 100% of that revenue. To fund their operations. We've worked extensively with them on preventing gentrification, getting with gentrification on the east side, and getting that neighborhood designated historic designation so that you don't see what happened in Brooklyn happen on the east side. We've been consistently named the company with heart by Jacksonville Magazine. We've been fastest growing in the Inc. 500 and JBJ for 10, 11 years, many, many times named a best place to work. Every year, for the last 4 years, we've built a home. We've raised money with a golf tournament and built a house and donated it for K-9 for Warriors Veteran. So we are very community-focused. I have three business partners. They're all about my age. We all have young kids. We all live in Jacksonville. We're not going anywhere. So we believe that Jacksonville is our home, and we need to make it a stronger place at the end of the day. So there's three main components of JWB's business. You have JWB Real Estate Capital, which is our development arm. It builds and sells properties. So we build about 300 to 500 infill houses per year and buy and renovate about 80 to 100 houses. Primarily what we do is we rent those houses out after we renovate them or build them, and then we sell that to an investor that wants to own it as a rental property. Our investors are not the large hedge funds. They're a doctor in California, a business owner here in Jacksonville, a CPA in New York. Probably 70% out of town, but they're individuals that don't want to invest all their money in the stock market. They want to invest some in real estate. JW Property Management is a separate company, obviously under our umbrella, that manages primarily single-family homes. So we manage about 4,900 single-family homes. We're the largest single-family property manager in Jacksonville by a pretty large margin. That business grows by 400 to 500 units a year because we sell 400 to 500 units a year, and then we mainly retain that management. And then Hoos Homes and Investments, which is our long-term, it's our entity that owns the real estate that JWB owns long-term. So we do own about 350 houses ourselves that we have long-term debt on that we're holding as our own long-term investment, along with land and commercial properties. We've recently been focusing a lot on downtown. So this is a quick map kind of showing you the locations of properties that JWB manages, focusing a lot on workforce housing. So you see Arlington, South Side, and a lot in the North Side and the West Side. But we do manage all over Jacksonville. We consider ourselves affordable housing experts. In 2017, we were presented with NEFBA's Affordable Housing Developer of the Year Award. And we believe ourselves to be a Jacksonville leader in creating affordable housing, workforce housing, without taxpayer dollars. So a big distinction between what we're doing and what a lot of other developers, for instance, Vestcor, which is an amazing company that has done some great things providing affordable housing for Jacksonville, they get federal dollars that allows them to rent those properties at a reduced price. Or even JHA. JHA is amazing, and we're working with them in a couple of projects right now. The way that they get affordable housing is they don't have to pay property taxes. So there's a significant expense that they don't have to pay, which allows them to lower the cost of housing. We don't get any of that. We don't get government financing, and we pay full property taxes. And we're still able to deliver affordable housing. We're probably the largest current creator of workforce rental housing in Jacksonville. 71% of our new construction properties, I just ran this number last night, are affordable to somebody who makes 80% of AMI. So there's a table that HUD comes out with every year that shows what is affordable housing. And so it shows the brackets of 80%, 60%, 30%. 71% of our new construction housing is affordable to somebody who makes 80% of AMI. The percentage of our units, so we manage 4,900 units, JWB Property Management. 94% of the units that we manage, so you're talking 4,600, 4,700 units, are affordable to somebody that makes 80% of AMI, according to HUD's guidelines. And 58% are affordable to somebody who makes 60% of AMI. It is very, very hard to build 60% affordable housing nowadays without government incentives. Right now, about 18% of the houses that we're building are affordable to somebody who makes 60% of AMI. The houses that we're building, renovating, it's slightly higher than that. So if you look at that, 71% of our new construction are affordable to somebody who makes 80%. About 18% are affordable to somebody who makes 60%. And so when you want to get down to like truly, truly affordable housing, 60% and 30%, that's where heavy, typically government incentives and subsidy, either through tax breaks or cash, are required. And I do want this to be open, so if anyone has any questions, feel free to raise your hand. Actually, we said no questions, right? I'll make an exception if somebody has a really important question. That's just a picture of kind of what we build. Our housing is high quality. It's inexpensive, but not, you know, we're not putting in a lot of, the faucet that's going to break in a year, or carpet. We put in laminate vinyl flooring. We put in granite countertops, things that are going to make that housing last for a long time because it is being held as an investment. All right, so affordable housing solutions. I kind of break this down into three different buckets. There's, of course, more than this, but these are the three big ones that I see. One is policy. There's a lot of policy that can create affordable housing. Through density, parking is an example, setbacks, zoning, and then regulation, which has potential to create affordable housing if it's done the right way. Subsidy. So subsidy is the main one that people think about, where you've got the government giving incentive to developers, like, for instance, the 9% LIHTC program that Vestcor typically uses. The federal government pays for a significant portion of those units, which is why they're able to be leased for less. I would also consider tax breaks to be a form of subsidy, or direct help to tenants. The the Section 8 program, where the government is giving money to tenants, and then I view this as potentially our biggest, going forward the next 10 to 15 years, the best way to get affordable housing through creativity or technology that lowers cost. So I consider infill building at the scale that we're doing creative. We are the largest infill builder in Jacksonville. It's a lot more difficult to build on a lot that was platted in the 1920s when you're dealing with drainage and utilities and a lot of other things than building on a new lot. But you can do it more, you can do it less expensively, which is how we're able to deliver affordable housing. We're buying these lots for $5,000, $10,000, $30,000, where a new lot nowadays, you can ask, as John in the back with your heart, and a new lot nowadays is minimum 70 and more like 100, 120 grand. And I think that technology going forward through 3D printing, modular, there will be some technologies coming out that are going to be able to lower costs going forward. Which one of these things do you guys think I want to focus on first? What? Policy. Well, policy is the most important one for this discussion, because obviously we have city council that has said that they're willing to start implementing policy that will create affordable housing. I want to talk about regulation. I'm not a laissez-faire free market guy. So I'm not anti-regulation by any means. I'm a registered Republican, but I voted for Hillary and Biden. I think that a great way to get more affordable housing is to tax rich people more, as long as that money is going to affordable housing. But I believe that the number one solution to the affordable housing crisis right now is creating more supply. And I think we need to be very, very careful about regulation that would decrease new supply. Because I think supply and demand, we learned in Economics 101, are the real drivers of price. And what's caused price to increase dramatically recently. In slight disagreement with Dr. Jaffe on that one.
Slight?
we had a conversation last week, so he knew this was coming. So, Dr. Jaffe's article that was in the paper, it primarily relied on an assumption that the real estate market in Jacksonville is no longer a competitive market, which I think is something that needs to be explored, but I found no actual data that supports that. And I think that any regulation really needs to be founded in data. So the Federal Trade Commission defines a monopoly, which is what I would define as having a non-competitive market, as a firm or a group of firms acting in concert that have more than 50%. So if a firm if a firm controls less than 50% of the market, they're not considered a monopoly. Or a group of firms working together. That's the FTC definition. So this is a slightly confusing slide, but I'm gonna kind of break it down. So first, let's look at the bottom right-hand corner. So it says top five owners and managers by number of properties in this market. This is an October report from John Burns, who's a housing consultant and economist that does analysis on real estate markets nationwide. So the largest owner in the market right now is Progress Residential that has about 4,200 units. Which is 4.5% of the market, not anywhere close to 50%. And then if you take all of the large owners, all the owners that own over 1,000 houses, which would be that 16,000, if you look up above where I was just showing you, the 16,828 that's circled in red, that's 18% of the market. So if you took all of them together and you said they are all working together and operating as one company, you would still only have 18% of the rental market, not the overall housing market, just the rental market owned by one actor. Now, this is a lot higher than the country as a whole. So the country as a whole, you can see, is about 3% owned by those large companies, but is very in line with large cities in the Southeast. So you can see Atlanta is at 22% owned. The rental market, once again, not the overall housing market, just the rental market. About 22% owned, Tampa's at 15, Orlando's at 14. So we're about middle of the market for the list for large southeastern markets. And just so we can be clear about how those numbers are, you can see on the portfolio size, investment property owners, so people that own rental property that own between 1 and 9 houses, about 60,000 units in Jacksonville. Owners that own between 10 and 99 is about 12,000 units. Owners that own between 100 to 999, which is where JWB would fall, owning about 350 units, is about 4,000 units. And then owners that own over 1,000 units is almost 17,000 units owned by those. So any way you slice it, you're nowhere close to 50% that could be considered a monopoly or a non-competitive market. All of these owners are making sure that they're hitting their returns, that their properties are filled, and I'll show you what that looks like with what our policy is in a second. Just to kind of break this down a little bit more, so this is talking about now about the total housing stock in Jacksonville. The last slide we looked at was just rental housing. So total housing stock, if you look at the area that's highlighted in yellow above, so there's about 670,000 housing units in Jacksonville. About 385,000 owner-occupied, 198,000 renter-occupied, about 85,000 that are vacant. And then that breakdown below on the total housing stock, you can see that about 426,000 units, one unit detached. And if you add all those up, you've got about 488,000 homes that would be considered single family between one and four units. So if you're looking at the total housing market, the largest property owner in Jacksonville owns less than 1% of the homes. So I would fail to see why the laws of supply and demand don't work when you're looking at numbers like that.
This is just for single-family homes, correct? Do you have multifamily?
Well, yes. So if you look actually on the five or more units, so the line below, so right below my highlight, so where you see five or more units, that is the number of multifamily units. So there's 129,000 multifamily units. So buildings that have five or more units, there's 129,000 of those in Jacksonville. So the single-family rental properties, there's 92,000. You're assuming that all of the multifamily units are rental housing. So it's probably 42% single-family, 58% multifamily as far as if you're looking at the total rental market in Jacksonville. So then we go to, even that, what's happening is you've got price fixing, you've got collusion, and owners are setting rents in unrelation to the market or where they should be or what demand is, which just isn't the case. So this is JWB's price rental price drop policy. I pulled it from our Google Doc. I enlarged the important stuff and I highlighted it. But this is our policy pulled directly from how we operate our business. And so we manage 4,900 homes. So our policy will affect Jacksonville real estate more than that one owner that owns 4,100 homes. We drop, so it says, this is instructions to the people who are doing this work. Drop using the rent prices according to below. If you're between 14 and 30 days in the market. So the first 14 days, we don't drop our rental price. What we do is we look at what rental comps are in the market. You say, okay, a three-bedroom house in this neighborhood should rent for $1,350. That's how we set the price. If the first 14 days, we don't drop rent. Between 14 and 30 days, we say we've reviewed deal eval. So that's saying, hey, we've told our investors that we give a buffer, let's say it was $1,250. So in the first 45 days, we're not going to drop below that. But absent dropping below that number, if we're based on leads, so based on the demand, we are dropping pricing even in day 15. 2 weeks, and we're willing to drop pricing if we're not getting the lead flow or demand for that property. That is a very market-driven way to understand what rent is in Jacksonville. And the pricing, once again, is driven by demand, the amount of people that are wanting rent houses, the amount of people that are moving here, which is driven by job growth, which is why the Southeast has been growing so quickly. 30 days on market, we're going to drop it even more. And then at 45 to 60 days is when, if it still hasn't rented, we go to the owner and we'll look at the rent that we said would be the baseline rent. We'll say, hey, there might be a mistake here and we might have to drop it below what we thought to get the house rented. The market is speaking. Another thing that I think we need to look at is, so right now, the last 2 years have been really painful. To to a lot of people, because you've seen there was a lot of job loss during the pandemic. Home prices have escalated. Rates have gone up. Everything has gotten more expensive. And I understand the pain and why there's a huge push for solutions right now, but it's really important to look at why. And I think that large property owners have become a scapegoat, because people are saying, well, they're buying a bunch of property now and prices have gone up. Those must be correlated. Well, they are correlated, right? But it might not be a causational relationship. But we're going to attribute that to it and try to create policy based on that. But I think it's important to look at the data and see, are these correlated and is there a causal relationship? So what I did is I pulled, let's look at the bottom graph first. So that's the annual percentage of investor purchases to total purchases. So you can see in 1997, about 23% of all purchases were investor purchases. That bumped up during 2006 to close to 30%, fell back down. And then in 2012 and 2013, over 36, 37% of the market was being bought by investors. Now, if we think that large investors and investors buying a lot of properties is the reason why you would get rent increases, then you would expect at that important time to have rent increases. But that's not what happened. Rents stayed below the historical average for a significant years after we already had investors buying 37, 36% of the market. And then rents did bump up in 2018 and 2019. We had growth above. Well, were investors to blame? Were they buying a lot of houses? No, they weren't. They weren't buying a lot of houses. And now we look, so the graph at the top is percentage increase in rents. So now current, you can see it shot up. We're currently at like 13% rent increases, which is unsustainable and very painful to a lot of people in the community. And because now investor purchases have also increased, we're like, it's got to be the investors. When you look back at data, that's one out of three times. Are those things correlated at all? They're actually negatively correlated before that. So that's probably not. Let's look deeper into the data. Which is when you look at job growth and demand and population growth across the Southeast, is where this is coming from. It's a supply and demand issue. There is higher demand here, higher demand for housing, which is why pricing is going up. Back to economics 101, not the large investor boogeyman. Just another indicator of that it is a supply and demand issue. Oh, and one more thing. So the prediction, so if we're looking at the graph on the top, you've got current. So currently we're at 13% growth. The prediction of John Burns over the next 3 years is that rent growth is going to fall dramatically. One, because it's gone up so much, there's a decrease in demand. And two, because there's a bunch of supply coming on the market. There's a lot of people building houses right now because there has been such demand. So even absent the work that we're going to do here, which is really important, the predictions are that relief is coming, and not as soon as we would all like it. And again, from an investor's perspective, we don't want this. For JWB's perspective, we would love to see normal 3.5% growth consistently. It makes our life so much easier. It makes the builder's life so much easier. When you see crazy price increases and then decreases and construction costs go up by 20%, it's not a good thing. I actually would have preferred over the last 2 years to not have prices increase like they have and not have construction costs increase. It would have made our business more profitable and much, much simpler. So the idea that a lot of property owners are excited about what's happened the past 2 years is not accurate. And just talk about supply and demand. So this is a graph showing months of inventory. So now we're talking about the for sale market. Just for a second, just to show supply and demand. The for sale market and the rental market, They have something to do with each other. Obviously, a lot of different drivers there. But on the top, the red line is historical equilibrium inventory. So the months of inventory metric in the for sale market, what that says is it determines if it's a buyer's or seller's market. So if there is 6,000 houses on the market today and 1,000 houses sold last month, then that's 6 months of inventory. You take the 6,000 on the market, you divide it by the 1,000 that sold last month, and what you're saying is, if no new homes were added to the market and the same pace continued, you would run out of inventory in 6 months. There is 6 months of inventory. Historically, about 6 months has been the break-even point where you get normal 3% appreciation. We've been in a low inventory environment for years, ever since 2013, 2014. So inventory was bumping between 3 and 4 months, and then right after the pandemic, cratered to less than 1 month of inventory because there was such demand. People were moving here. That's what caused price increases. Well, guess what? Price increases decrease demand. People can't afford it. Rate increases decrease demand. And inventory is now skyrocketing. So there's back to 3 months of inventory, which is still way less than a normal market. But it shows that, to me, it shows that the real estate market is a competitive market and is very susceptible to supply and demand and changes in pricing because it's happening right in front of us. So talking about regulation, I think there is regulation that could work, but any regulation that is going to create less supply is a hugely negative thing, in my opinion, right now. So I want to focus on density. How do we create more supply? This is the thing that me and Dr. Jaffe agree on 100%. That the solution to missing middle housing isn't a new solution. It was the way we were building housing in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And some of our best neighborhoods in Jacksonville are built out with missing middle housing. So the concept of missing middle housing is everything between a single family home and a large apartment complex. So you've got duplexes, you've got townhomes, you've got courtyard buildings, you've got fourplexes, you've got small apartment buildings. This is the way that housing was built in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. You look at Riverside. Riverside, San Marco, and Springfield, three of our most vibrant, expensive neighborhoods, desirable neighborhoods, are built out in this way. You've got a single-family home next to a duplex, next to a small apartment complex, next to a single-family home on smaller lots. And what that does, two things. So the mix of having different housing in the same neighborhood provides different price points. So a single-family home is going to be a lot more expensive. It's 2,000 square feet. It's going to rent for a lot more than a 600-square-foot unit in a quad. And so you provide different price points within the same neighborhood, which gets people of different backgrounds and different incomes all living together, which I think has a completely, extremely important positive side benefit of reducing this polarization that's been happening because you've got people that have a lot of money living in the single-family neighborhoods, and you've got people that can't afford to buy a house in the apartments, and you've got affordable housing, you know, in the affordable housing complex over here, whereas historically you had all these types of housing in the same neighborhood. And this is just an example. This is Riverside at Riverside Avenue and Copeland Street. You can see, is there a laser pointer, I guess? Well, you can see by the, you've got single family homes, you've got apartment complexes, you've got smaller apartment complexes, you've got duplexes all together next to each other on small lots. This is just a breakdown. I know that the words are kind of small, but the concept is if you take a lot, a 40 by 100 lot, and you build one house on it, over all the way over on the left, the rent that you would need, you can look at the lot costs 50 grand, build costs are 125 a foot, you've got soft costs, you're all in for that house for $350,000. The rent needed to achieve a 5% return would be almost, you know, $2,500. If you built two units on that lot, you're splitting the cost, so instead of 50,000 a unit, you're only 25,000 a unit. You're going to build a smaller unit. It's just not physically possible to build the same 2,000 square foot unit. So your build costs go down from 250 to 187. Your all-in cost is 255 instead of 350, and your rent is only 1,700 needed. Now you build a quad on that unit. You got four 900 square foot apartments. Build cost goes up a little bit when you're talking about building a quad, but you're all in on those units for 177 each, and you only need to rent that unit for 1,200 to get to a 5% return. This is the power of getting back to missing middle housing and increasing zoning to reduce costs. And even more important than the fact that the rent for those units went from 2,400 to 1,200 is the fact you created four more of them. You quadrupled the supply, which is going to drive down costs. So I know I've been up here for a long time, but just talking about easy-ish wins. So number one, pass the current ADU legislation. There's legislation going through city council right now that would allow ADUs all across Jacksonville. ADUs are already allowed in our historic neighborhoods where missing middle housing is built out, like Springfield and Riverside, but they should be allowed everywhere across Jacksonville. So an ADU accessory dwelling unit means you can basically build a small house, mother-in-law suite, in your backyard. A lot of these are rented out and provides typically small, affordable housing. Allowing small lot single family in residential medium density, RMD, residential medium density zoning areas. So right now, if you have a piece of land zoned RMD, you can build 20 units an acre. You can, if you have 1 acre, you can build 20 apartments on it. You can't physically build 20 houses on that lot, on that piece of property. You can't actually fit them with the current zoning, which requires typically a minimum 5,000 square foot lot. If you allowed smaller lot sizes, like what was done in the East Side and Brooklyn and Springfield, you can get 10 to 12 houses an acre that could be sold, which would be much more affordable for sale housing. So the zoning already allows for a number of units. Instead of just doing them as a large apartment complex, why not allow them as single-family platted lots? Making it easier to develop small infill sites. So currently, if you buy a piece of property that you want to make into three lots that is on an existing road, so you buy a half-acre piece, it's zoned for three lots, to split it into three lots, you have to go through the same exact process as you do to develop a new 300-unit greenbelt subdivision that you're going to have to build all the roads, water, sewer, infrastructure to. I think we can do a lot to streamline small infill sites that will make it much easier to develop those. So the reason people don't develop these small infill sites because it's just as expensive and there's as much brain damage as developing 300 units. So why do three when you can do 300? I think increasing density for infill lots zoned RMD, allowing quads on all existing RMD lots. Currently it's limited by the size. So for example, in RMDB right now, to build a quad, you need 0.34 acres. Where there's quads all over Springfield on 35 by 100 lots, or 35 by 125 lots, that are 0.84 to 0.1 acres. It's physically possible to do it, and these neighborhoods have been obviously not hurt by that to allow quads on smaller lots. Look at setback and parking requirements, and then expanding RMD zoning areas, areas currently zoned low density. There's a lot of areas that are zoned low density that historically were not, and rezoning those to medium density that could allow for duplexes and quads would be an easy-ish win. You're still going to get pushback for that. I believe that the big win is to remove single-family zoning within the urban area. This is not easy. There's cities that have done it. Gainesville just recently did it. So Gainesville gave the first okay to eliminate exclusionary zoning. So Gainesville got rid of single-family zoning within their city limits. Minneapolis did it a couple years ago. We've learned a lot from that on what other policy worked, what didn't. It's been in some court battles. But I think that this is a huge win that will greatly increase the supply of housing and make housing more affordable. Now, what does the urban area mean? So this is the 2030 mobility plan. The green area is the urban area. It's basically the old city limits of Jacksonville before consolidation, from what I understand. So that would be the urban area, where if we could remove single-family zoning in those areas, it would potentially add a significant amount of housing over time. A lot of those areas are built out, so you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck on teardowns and on lots that haven't been built on. So if you've got a house, a derelict house, instead of tearing down and building one more house, if you could build a quad, you're adding four more units to the market. And then the urban priority area, if the urban area, the green area, was politically unable to be done, then I would focus on the urban priority area, which is the area in yellow. And that's about all I had. So I will turn it over to our next speaker. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Now we have Taka Chester with Family Promise. If you introduce yourself and start with your panel discussion.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is... I don't have a slide.
Oh.
My name is Taka Chester. I work with the Rapid Rehousing Program, the Federal Rapid Rehousing Program, with Changing Homelessness, and it's in conjunction with Family Promise of Jacksonville. So I was tasked to, well, let's give a little backstory. Before I got here, the city was given, I believe, $2.5 million to rapidly rehouse the homeless population. So basically, you're going to pull all the people that you see homeless in the street, put them in a hotel program to then shelter them stably in a house or an apartment or a dwelling of some sort so they can be stably housed and able to be self-sufficient on their own. I was tasked to rehouse those individuals, and this was during the COVID scare, and there weren't any jobs, and people started losing their homes and jobs and everything else. And now it just seems like that everyone is back to normal. There's still a whole mess of people out there that is not, they're not being served. I can just talk louder.
No, if you like that. We're trying to record.
Yeah, we're trying to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So my problem is housing people. All of the affordable housing talk and all the investing talk and all of the real estate talk is great on this level, but I'm down here housing everyone that's down here. So they don't even meet the 50% of requirement AMI. They don't meet the 80%. They won't meet the 60% because most of my homeless population are disabled or seniors or veterans or families that have fallen off the wagon some kind of way, either their fault or no fault of their own, and they just can't afford it. So there can be 1,000 affordable homes out there, but affordable for whom? Not for my sector of people. So
there's it.
You get all this money, and we have all this money to house all the people, but no one will house them. You have all these homes that are being built. You have all of the apartments being rented. No one, these individuals can't afford to buy a home. They can't afford to get any kind of other assistance. So I'm working in tandem with two different entities. The federal government, who's provided, and you can say unlimited because these funds will never be just a chunk pulled out to rehouse people. It's going to be a little by little by little, but we're helping so many people that that will add up. So I'm also working with the state and the Jacksonville Housing Authority and their emergency housing vouchers. That's going to fund people for a certain length of time with a certain amount, and it's capped out depending on, I guess, their lot in life, whether they're making income or whether they're not making income. They don't care if they're working or not, because if you receive a Social Security check, that means you have income. That doesn't matter if their Social Security check that they get once a month is $861, now $831, and the rent to move them in somewhere, the HUD voucher will pay $800, or it'll pay $739. They give them a sheet of zip codes that really are way below market value for rent. So when you come up against a landlord or a property manager who would take full market value to rent something to someone regular, they would rather do that as opposed to taking vouchers because the state takes forever to pay. When I send someone over to get an emergency housing voucher, it takes forever. You're looking at least 30 to 45 days before anybody gets housed, and that's even seen to be filling out paperwork to get a voucher that says they can't even be housed. So now that takes a whole nother 30 days to try to get them to where they can get a little more money. So what happens is they pass something saying they can get a reasonable accommodation. If I have an individual that has a housing voucher and they're senior or disabled, anyway, in order for them to be housed and remain stably housed or get stably housed, I'm going to request for a reasonable accommodation for them, which would increase their voucher by 120%. So now their voucher goes from them being able to afford $729 to about $900-something, or from $900 or $800 to over $1,000, which is fine, and it sounds really good on paper. But when you're out here talking to people and calling every single property manager, every single apartment complex, all the HUD-subsidized places, you don't even know. You can't get housed. Something was just passed about hurry up and go out and get an emergency assistance voucher. Hurry up and go out and get this all this emergency assistance that the state is offering or that Jacksonville is offering. No one told the people to accept it. So while you have a lot of the population running out to get emergency assistance vouchers, none of the landlords are taking them. So now what? You still have the same amount of people. And guess what? The voucher only lasts for 30 days. Mm-hmm. So they only get two extensions in their lifetime. So now I have to hurry up and try to get them extended, increased, and rehoused with all their other barriers within the next 30 days. And I only get to do it twice. You would hope that somebody tries to work with you over at the Housing Authority, the Jacksonville Housing Authority, which is now the Housing Authority because they're branching out. I can't even get Duval County secured. So I'm not sure where they're branching out to, but we need help here. And they pass out all kind of federal funds. It's another program that's coming out, the RUSH program, and that's to rapidly rehouse more people. They gave an initial allocation of $6.8 million. I'm still not running through the $2.5 million that I already have because I can't find anyone to house these individuals. I have people that have disabilities. They may not need to have the units altered, like the sinks lowered or the toilets lowered or the doorways widened, but they need to be able to get into the place. A lot of these lots, they have dirt, grass. A lot of these places are in low-lying zones, which means what? If it sprinkles, it floods. Now you can't even get there, so I can't house anyone there. They can't even walk up the stairs. They have to be next to or near their places of therapy or their rehab centers or their doctor's offices. It's a lot. Then you have, you're working with the Jacksonville Transit Authority to try to get some type of assistance with funding on getting them where they need to go. So whereas my program, anything that I pay for, I can federally pay for. My program covers moving costs. It covers childcare expenses. It covers rental assistance, security deposits, utility deposits. It covers landlord incentives. So that if someone runs your credit and for whatever reason you don't meet $650 points or higher, they won't rent to you. If you don't have two or three times the income, they won't rent to you. That's on a normal basis. But on my voucher, I have a range between $100 and $202. Technically, they're supposed to multiply that $202, if I'm using this voucher, by three. And that's the max that they're able to pay. That doesn't happen. So now what? So now I'm sitting on a voucher for a group of people and I can't even house. I currently have 28 clients. We started with 12 case managers. We're down to one. There were three 2 weeks ago. Now there's one. That'd be me. So how can I house all these people? You have team leads now that's taken over 20 cases or 17 cases or 15 cases trying to get all these people housed. I only want to do what's best. Changing homelessness model is housing first. So that means I have to go by what the client wants. If they got a voucher, I have to ask them, do you want to use your housing voucher, which means you go through the housing authority only, or do you want to use my funds? My go around for that is I'll use my funds to house you because I can pay for any fee that gets popped up. The problem is their credentials don't match. So you might hit on two or three things and you can qualify, but now you're held back because of an eviction or whatever. So that's when the landlord incentive comes into play. And I can say, well, I can offer you a certain amount of money just to get them housed. Can you help me? Sometimes yes, most of the time no, because no one wants to take a risk. So that's when the two times or the three times the security deposit comes into play, because what if you leave the place in disarray or something like that? I need to be able to recoup all the money that they spend to invest into these properties to build them up for people. Saying that, you have other property managers that they claim the place is move-in ready. I have spent so much money driving out and getting Ubers or Lyft rides out to these places that are move-in ready, and they are definitely not move-in ready. I have my own habitability standards report inspection that I have to conduct before I will move someone in. If I wouldn't move myself or my mother or my grandmother in there, I'm not moving a tenant in there. And some of these individuals, they say, well, I'm living in a tent. I could take anything. I understand you will take anything, but I won't put you anywhere that you're going to be harmed. There's no locks on the doors. There's busted windows out. There's one back burglar bar, but not one in the front. Or you have a burglar bar, but the lock's broken out. Like, I need all of these things fixed. And then you send me an addendum to the lease saying, well, if all of these things are broken, it's $35 for a sink. It's $35 for a handle. It's, okay, well, are you going to fix the 39 infractions that I found before I move them in there? Because if you can't fix this, then we're moving on to the next property. I'm not going to move someone in, and I know that they can't afford it. So why would I move you somewhere In my federal funds, I can move you anywhere, but that's another problem that I'm facing, taking on other people's cases. I can move you in somewhere, but I'm not going to move you in knowing that your voucher only covers $700. The rent is already $850. You can't afford it. I'm not going to move you in there. The goal when the program is over is for everyone to be stably housed, period. If I can't stably house you up front, I'm not going to Band-Aid that situation just so you can get off the street or whatever. The conditions of the shelters are deplorable, so no one wants to be in the shelter. I have half of my clients, they would rather sleep in a tent, under the bridge, wherever, besides going back to the shelter. You have places like Trinity that will kick the people out during the day. Where is this mom and her children supposed to go during the day if they're not from here, or they are from here and she's got a newborn? I rescued someone when I worked at Clara White. Running across the street, she was trying to push her stroller with her two-year-old and, well, with her baby in it, and the two-year-old was, he's autistic and nonverbal. He was running back the other way. I happened to be circling the building, ran across the street and caught him before he ran in the street. I'm like, where are you going? They just got kicked out from Trinity because they couldn't keep their food that they had. It's prepackaged food, not food that was open. She couldn't keep it in her suitcase, and she's a very clean lady, but she couldn't keep her stuff there. They had to kick her out. So where is she supposed to go during the day? Where? At the bus stop where all the everyone else is that do everything else at the bus stop? That's not safe for her. Like, where do we put the disabled veteran who, you remember, we work, Clara White is mainly focused on housing and helping transition veterans from homelessness to stable housing. They need help. You can't just sit them out there and hope for the best. You have all these programs that are saying they're going to help and they're going to do this and do that. But when you meet these people face to face, you're doing nothing. So I need some type of help to overcome the barriers. What about the rental problem? What about income? What about holding fees? I don't feel like I should have to pay per person. I don't feel like I should have to pay an $85 application fee and a $100 holding fee just to be put on a wait list that's 6 to a year or 2 to 4 years of a waiting list. What are you waiting on? I asked, what are they waiting on? How do you clear this waiting list of 36 people? Oh, well, in about 6 months or 5 weeks, we'll have about 6 people that are about to be moving out. It took me about a year to get housed with my voucher. Do you think I'm going anywhere? I'm not going anywhere. So in 6 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 months, when the lease is up, they just renew. And unless you caught the apartment on fire or the house on fire, you're paying your rent. They're going to keep you, which means all those people have to wait, what, another 6 months to a year or whatever. Their voucher has expired. So I'm talking to you in July saying I need an immediate place or somewhere within the next, you know, 2 months before this voucher runs out. But you have an availability in November. That won't help me. You know, and so they keep pushing back the date of the program. So it's good for me because I can help house people. But when the program is actually over, what's going to happen then? Who's going to help house everyone? Everyone wants to get rid of the crisis of homelessness. But who is helping building things that people cannot afford? Like, I deal with JWB property management, not the capital part. So it's a lot of those places I called. And even in Arlington, in the most rundown part of Arlington, the apartment is $600 or $650. I know my person can get in it, but guess what? They don't take vouchers. So I can't house them because at the end of this, they can't pay for it by themselves. And they only make $800 in Social Security. That's $600 for rent, whatever it costs for utilities. And then some of them don't even take the vouchers. So you have, like, I've called everyone. I've made my own list. You know how I am. I make my own list. I made a whole nother binder just for property management people, everyone that says they can do something. What's the waiting list? What's this? What's that? And all I get are publications and more publications of millions of dollars being dropped into places. I have places that haven't been inspected. I have places that won't be inspected. They're getting state funds and they're not doing anything. Who's governing that? Like, who advocates for the clients? All I can do is advocate for the clients. I can't build anything. I can't make anything. I can't pay for everybody to be housed. I can only do what I can do in my scope to try to get you stably housed, but I want to do it the right way. I'm not going to cut corners. I can't cut corners. It's federal funds, and my name is very unique, and it will not be signed on anybody's document that does not match up. It's just not going to happen. That's not how I roll. So I need assistance in making the circle close. I needed to not be a C, and I needed to close into a whole circle to help people out. I need people to pick people up and actually rehouse them. I know they don't like Tent City, but there was Tent City. I'm sure everybody knows about Tent City. It's any pretty much any big lot that will hold about 30 tents for random people. And they love that little community. It's not much, and it's nothing that we would do. But I can't say me because I camp, and I grew up in the woods. But a lot of us wouldn't do that. So where do they go? They decided they wanted to rehouse them. The term that they put was rehouse them, and they were going to hold them somewhere safe for 30 days while they get them stably housed. And it turned out to be a back of a mission that had a whole big room like this with a whole bunch of cots in it. So I get what you're saying from one perspective, but then I was looking at it from their perspective. I just gave up my private 2 to 4 person or 4 to 6 person tent to come live in a community room in a cot where I have no privacy and COVID's still rampant. What's going on? I don't want to do that. So they didn't stay. I didn't blame them, but I understand where they're coming from. I made the food and brought it over there. I understand where they're coming from. I have worked at Clara White. I have fed how many homeless people, Ms. Pittman? I have done it all. I've volunteered at Volunteers in Medicine for forever, where they help the working uninsured. That's people who have a job and no insurance, and you can go get free health care. It depends on your income, but most of the time you can get free health care there. I mean, I've been around every different scope from the bottom to the top, and everybody has somewhat of a common goal, but it's not coming to fruition. And more meetings on top of more meetings, where's the call to action? Where is somebody going to say, let's take this money and house these people? Somebody has to take a risk. You've already taken the risk and built the property, but you can't give it to everyone that needs it. Most of the homeless people cannot afford it. They are on hard times. They don't have cars. They had a car. They lost a car. They lost a job. I had a lady come up to Family Promise yesterday. She has 4 kids. She's been to every agency in this city, and no one can help her. No one's taken anybody. Emergency shelters don't have a child that's 15 years of age. They will split your family up. Now, me as a parent, I don't know how I feel about me and 2 of my kids here while my 15-year-old boy is somewhere else with a group of random men that I don't know. I'm just not safe with that. I don't want to split my family up just so we can have shelter for the night. I don't want to do that. But no one can keep families housed. So there needs to be some type of solution. I don't even know where to start. But I would think everybody that says they're working together needs to actually work together. If I have a program that's giving me unlimited federal funds to house you, I have to decide whether or not I'm going to double dip, which I can't do that. I have to let the client choose where they want to be housed. I did that with one of my clients, and she chose to be housed the Housing Authority way. That has been a mess because I'm very thorough and I'm very detailed and very organized about how I work. If I send you an email to say I need assistance on getting a housing voucher increased or extended and you don't reply, I'm going to reply to you again. I'm going to give you at least 3 times, and I'm going to copy your supervisor on it. If you didn't respond to that, I'm going to leave you a voicemail, copy your supervisor, and copy my supervisor. After that, imagine my dismay that it's started in the end of July, and now it's the end of September, beginning of October, and I've copied everyone in the Housing Authority, except for the co-chair there, the director there. I've copied all of my changing homelessness people, and nobody's responding to me. I get it. But you can't not respond. There's always somewhere else I can go. I'm going to keep advocating for these clients because they don't have anybody else. That's just what it is. It's not me, but that's just what it is. I'm so sorry. But it's crazy. These people need help, and I can't help everyone. But I'm trying. And it's hard because I am nowhere near all of you guys. Your council people and real people and investors, I don't have that. I just have me helping them from the ground. Somebody needs to help. Somebody needs to do something. There needs to be inspections conducted. Somebody needs to follow up with people. Look at people like they're people. Help these people out.
Thank you.
Wow. I think we've had a little bit of everything this morning and for the past few weeks. And I'm sorry, I kind of get emotional about this as well, because affordable housing and really housing for everybody is a necessity, you know. And I hope that we're just not going through the process. In the past weeks, I think we've gotten it raw. And everybody that's been in this room and these rooms and the other, from homelessness to mental health, it all goes together. You can't really have one without the other. And, you know, right now I'm real emotional because I've seen what people have gone through. Alex know we've had conversation. I've worked with Kalina in terms of trying to develop communities. And it's all true. And guess what? In most cases, we're all not talking together. And you just got the real of the realist of what's happening on the bottom floor, not what's happening up here. So I'm hoping as you all are listening in the room and the relationships that you all have, Alex and Kalina, how do we really make the connection? And it's not a short-term kind of fix. It's a long-term fix because it just didn't start. And it's not a Band-Aid approach. You know, hearing Taka talk, I feel like she's handcuffed. She has the resources, but the resources are not really real. You know? So I'm going to stop because I got to gather myself together. And let's talk about the SWAT and how the SWAT is going to help us develop modifications, reforms, whatever word we want to use to make some things happen.
Okay, we do want to give people some time to ask questions, but we only have an hour left. So maybe we can combine your review of the results of the SWAT with some comments and questions related to what's been presented, and if we can tie things to recommendations for the City Council, that would be the best way to spend the last hour. So I'm going to distribute the results of the SWOT analysis. Many of you filled it out. Take a look at what other people have indicated in the SWOT analysis. All right, so I will distribute the SWOT analysis. You can see what other people have indicated. You may see in the summary of the feedback we received. Oh, thank you. Oh, great. You can see in the feedback that we received, you may see something that you wrote. Maybe you would like to elaborate further on that. But the point is I'd like people to take a little time to look over the feedback that we received on a SWOT analysis. I also have included on the last page a list of some of the policy implications of the feedback and material and presentations that have been made. So it would be useful if you also looked at those policy implications and which of those you think are the most important, maybe even which should take the top priority. So again, the first page is the SWOT items we created. The second and third pages cover the feedback we received. The fourth page lists some of the policy implications. Some of these were discussed last Thursday, but we did not get any feedback on them. So maybe take a few minutes to look this over, and then we can build that into the conversation as well as the questions that you have for the panelists. How's that sound? Yes. You may notice in the feedback SWOT materials, there are asterisks that represent something that was mentioned at least twice. And if there's multiple asterisks, that was something that was mentioned by numerous people. There is also room on the last page if you would like to add your own policy recommendation, and you can just pull that page off and return it to me. We would like to get as much feedback as possible. Thanks.
If you have questions and you have a neon card, please get that to me right now. I have five cards. And I think what we'd like to do to make sure we have time for the discussion of the SWOT analysis is to ask these five questions. And I'm going to ask you all to do at least 2 minutes and rather three so we can get to the SWOT analysis. Is that okay with you all? Okay. Okay. I'm going to call Michael Hodges up. Okay.
I'm going to bypass right now.
You're going to bypass?
I'm under the weather right now. So
I'm sorry?
I'm a little bit under the weather.
Okay.
So it's kind of like my thoughts are all.
Okay, down. Not a problem. Next, we have Christina Kittle. And after her, we have Maria Garcia.
Christina Kittle, usually just say address on file, but my exact address is 2523 Forbes Street, which is a Duke fourplex or whatever. There's four units. I absolutely love my unit. It's very modest, and I think it's affordable right now. But in 1 week, my landlord is going to try to keep up with the price. Excuse me. He's going to try to keep up with the raising rent of the apartment complexes owned by JWB around the corner, which would cause a $520 increase into my rent. And I do not qualify for any subsidized housing. I do not qualify for any assistance. I make money. I have a great career. So I'm kind of in limbo here. I don't know what I'm going to do when me living as a single person in a place that's very modest in a neighborhood that everybody loves, that everybody has mentioned multiple times as being one of the best neighborhoods in Jacksonville, which I agree with, which is why I'm so passionate about advocating all the time at City Hall about Jacksonville being the best city and the residents deserving the best. But I've never felt more betrayed by my city in the last 2 years. So I went through a whole, exactly everything you're talking about as far as trying to apply for a place, including things with specifically JWB when I went to try and apply they brought up a criminal record of mine that charges were dropped. It doesn't even exist, which I found out through these meetings is legal, so I will be talking to Jacksonville Area Legal Aid on that. And just other things, like houses falling apart, things not being kept up. Florida Rising, we have, you know, we came proposing for the housing state of emergency. We understand with Hurricane Ian that other cities are actually going through a bigger state of emergency, so now we're coming with the Tenant Bill of Rights. That is the least that the city could do for people like me who are just in the middle. So even if things happen that have more vouchers, which we all know don't really work anyway, but I wouldn't even be somebody who could apply for that. But I also can't keep up with the raising rent, so I don't want to end up homeless and have an awesome, stable career at the same time in my 30s, which is crazy. So I'm a little all over the place as it approaches closer to November 1st, because I am in a real crisis right now, personally. I don't know what to do. So I'm asking y'all, with the power to do something, to please at least pass a Tenant Bill of Rights. So many of the things that have been mentioned are covered in that, and it would just give us a little bit of time.
Thank you, Christina. Thank you.
And this is a monopoly. They get all the time in the world to talk about things, but we only get 2 minutes. So it is a monopoly. I don't care what anyone says.
Hi, my name is Maria Garcia. My address is on file. I'm a resident of the Brentwood neighborhood, and I come representing the Jacksonville Theory of Change table. So I just wanted to read to y'all a testimony that we got, we collected, because unfortunately these meetings are a little bit prohibitive to working people who are the ones being affected, unfortunately, to being able to come and talk themselves. But this is a story from Rachel, who has been renting or leasing with JWB for about 2 years. She says the application process was a complicated and difficult one. During the entire process, JWB was hard to communicate with, and they weren't able to move into the property during their requested move-in window that they was given to them in the beginning. The leasing agreement they were given may have been the worst and shocking part of the whole ordeal. She says, in summary, our leasing agreement states that JWB is pretty much not responsible for any maintenance repairs. She says, I've never experienced a leasing agreement as unforgiving as JWB's. We as tenants are required to submit maintenance orders to JWB, but then cover the costs completely for such repairs. Several times JWB has been hard to communicate with, and it's hard to get a maintenance worker sent out to fix things, even though any cost of which will be handled by the tenant. She says she does not recommend leasing through JWB by any means. Their presence is harming the Jacksonville community overall, and that in the Arlington area alone, JWB has bought the local affordable housing available pretty much all of it to turn into a rental property. The whole process is exploitative, as the working class people in this area are practically pushed into having to go into JWB rental agreements that with the contracts that are not forgiven. And she says it's sad to see, and she thinks action needs to be done to stop this from continuing any longer. I think the YIMBYism that is coming from these groups like this needs to be seriously taken with skepticism. These are groups of people that are asking for unregulated ability to build in whatever neighborhoods they want, our urban neighborhoods. Fix things up. We already know how this goes. Call it like it appears to be luxury next to what there is, and gentrify.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Garcia. I think it's Latia Harmon.
Hi, it's Letitia Harmon.
Okay.
I am the Policy and Research Director.
Could you give us your address as well?
I live on Hampton Park in Jacksonville.
Okay, thank you.
And I am the Policy and Research Director for Florida Rising. Thank you very much for the opportunity to give public comment. I really appreciated the presentations today, and I think what we are hearing is basically oversimplified, but boiled down, I think we're talking about the cost of housing, the amount of housing that is out there, and the quality and the fairness of the housing that is available to us. And there is this argument being made that it is going to all be addressed by supply. And I'm not here to tell you don't build affordable units. If we need more houses, that must match the needs of our population. We need more affordable units in Jacksonville. Now, I will say there is a legal definition that can get dicey between workforce and affordable. In the presentation, we heard 80% and above, up to 140% of AMI qualifies for workforce housing. So there is a much higher rental cap for that type of housing. and it is accessible to people who have, of course, a higher income. I would advocate that we prioritize that 80% and below, which is actually the legal definition of affordable housing, because this is our most vulnerable population. These are the folks who are having the hardest time finding places to live while prices are skyrocketing. So the emphasis needs to be on that affordable housing unit and expanding the number that we have, not just on the workforce housing. And because we are talking about supply, I think it's important to note that it is going to, there is no way to just let the free market address it, because we all need housing. As much as I try to keep evolving as a person, I haven't been able to develop gills or fur, and so I still need shelter. And this is not a moving target. This is, if you're a person, you need shelter. And there's artificial scarcity created that looks like the demand is going way higher than the population we actually have, when investors buy up and hold property and wait for the market to move in their favor. Or they buy up and hold property that is vacant. Or very wealthy people own multiple homes and leave them vacant. So there is an artificial scarcity that does not actually mean that the demand we're seeing is real demand.
Thank you, Ms. Harmon. Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you.
I do have a proposal for the SWOT analysis that involves a tenant's Bill of Rights.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. John Sapor. Name and address, please.
Good morning, John Sapora, 1849 Challen Avenue in Avondale. I work with LISC Jacksonville as the Housing Resiliency Coordinator. And I wanted to bring up what LISC is working on really quietly right now with other partners in town, including Legal Aid, the Community Foundation, others. A lot of affordable housing is about looking to find ways to bring people into housing, to deal with the supply of housing. And the rental housing market is absolutely an opportunity for us. But what LISC is really looking at is trying to preserve housing, and especially home ownership, preserving home ownership, and to build wealth through home ownership, especially in our majority black neighborhoods. And we're doing it. There's so many ways that people can't get into housing, but really what's happening over and over again every year is people are losing title to their homes through various means, either through heirs property, meaning they're fragmented title, they haven't gone through the probate process. So we're working with Legal Aid. And we are the number one market in the Southeast for heirs properties. We might have over 29,000 heirs properties in Duval County. That's an epidemic. That's an epidemic that we need to stop. So people are losing title through tax certificates, through not getting homestead, and their taxes go up. So it's about educating the community and residents, and actually dealing with investors that come in that might want to buy and want, you know, to pay $50,000 to somebody for 30 days might sound like a great deal, but they're losing equity in their home. And so we want to help educate residents about that. The other is that our majority black neighborhoods have a history of devaluation of homes. So it's very hard to build equity when your homes are devalued and you use market, which is really a legacy of redlining, and these neighborhoods are already devalued. And so
thank you, John.
It's about
thank
preserving
you.
Home ownership is another way to deal with affordable housing.
Okay. Thank you so much. I want to thank everyone for their public comments, and now we will go to the SWOT analysis.
Okay, so I hope everyone has had a chance to look over the feedback we received, as well as the policy implications, potential policy recommendations. I think we can allow individuals to come up and say something about the SWOT analysis, what aspects they think are most critical. If there was something you included in the SWOT analysis, I know that you didn't have a lot of time to fill that out, and I have reduced many of the comments that people made in the SWOT analysis to several words to fit into the table. So if there is something that you included there that you think is important to inform the recommendations we are going to make, that's what I think the focus needs to be on, please come forward and share your thoughts. And make sure you don't spend too much time, because there may be others behind you.
Do you want to give me a time limit?
I don't like to give people a time limit. I feel very uncomfortable doing that, and I'm sorry we had to do that before.
It's okay. I will be succinct, and I will stop talking.
And I just don't know how many other people are interested in stepping up, so that's the question.
I want to submit for this committee's consideration a tenant's bill of rights, which essentially comprises seven things. That would be creating an office of the tenant advocate or housing advocate. It's called various things in other city. But it's a dedicated office that would be staffed and fully funded by the city. As we were talking about, you know, we've heard in previous presentations that we are one of the most landlord-friendly states in the United States. Florida is. And so landlords have their advocate. They have their legal representation. We need the tenant advocate. As we heard in today's presentation, who's advocating for tenants? We need an office that is dedicated to that and to holding signed copies of a tenant's bill of rights that would be presented to a tenant when they sign a lease. We would also like a landlord registry. I think on Dr. Jaffe's analysis of the items that were most mentioned, the one with the most asterisks is predatory landlords and institutional investors. What we want to do is we want to have a publicly searchable database so that I, the renter, know who I'm renting from. They can do a background check on me. They can know everything about my current and past life. I cannot do a background check on a landlord. I can't find out if they are in compliance. I cannot find out if they are well-liked by their tenants and have good policies. So we need something that makes that available to people who are looking to rent property. We also are asking for non-discrimination in the rental application process. As was talked about by Christina Kittle, as has been talked about by the presenter today, sometimes the barrier is the rental application itself. We need to expand this to make sure that people are not discriminated on because they are part of the LGBTQ community. We need to make sure that it includes non-discrimination for source of income, for immigration status, and for prior criminal conviction. We need returning citizens to be able to actually return to society as full and productive members and citizens, and having housing is a major component of that. The other is to have fee transparency on leases so that tenants know what they're getting into. Am I going to be charged for parking, for trash? Am I charged for maintenance? Are there late fees? Just to have that enumerated, because predictability in cost is one of the most important things when you are assessing where you're going to live in. What kind of sacrifices from your own income you need to make. The other is expanded notice for changes to a rental lease. This is all that is allowed by state law, but it isn't mandated by state law that you would give 90 days notice of termination to a lease, and 60 days if they're month to month, and if there's going to be a rent increase greater than 5%, that you give them 60 days notice to let them know your rent is going up, again, with that predictability in housing costs that allows people to plan. I have some data on this that I discovered last year from a JAMA Pediatrics article that actually addresses the health impacts on children that was the basis of this recommendation. I'm happy to share that. It basically talks about health impacts, higher infant mortality, lower birth weights, et cetera, when people have to quickly move out of their home because they have no idea their lease is ending. We also talked quite a bit last time about right to counsel. Just want to reaffirm that as a priority, because 81% of landlords have legal representation and only 3% of tenants do. So we think that a right to counsel program would be is necessary. I want to also add a right to repair, which speaks directly to this maintenance issue. Right now, by Florida state law, a tenant can withhold rent after they have informed a landlord that there's a necessary maintenance issue, but they can't actually make the repairs themselves unless the landlord gives them written consent to do so. So what we would like to do is say, we've informed the landlord, here's a necessary repair, but for those landlords who are negligent or slow moving, the tenant has the ability to then make the repair and deduct that cost of repair from their rent rather than just withholding the rent. So those are the seven items, the seven policy solutions we want to submit to you that address some of these structural inequities and some of what I think is at the root of this housing crisis. Yes, more affordable units. Let's do that. While we're doing that, let's make them good. Let's put policies into place that protect the people who live in those units and make sure that they are living safe and healthy lives in their affordable housing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hand this to you. Or
yes.
Thank you very much.
I do have a couple of questions, if I might, of the panelists. I mean, the focus on today was best practices. I'm not hearing a lot of that. So I wanted to ask, particularly as you talk about the frustration that you're experiencing, and I certainly do appreciate and understand it, as you well know. I'm wondering if you have done any homework as to what's happening around the state and other places that is addressing the concerns that you're raising, because I need to hear that. Also, in the context of your comments with respect to, as you work in other parts of the state, what practices or policies that are in place that are making what you're trying to do easier? So I appreciate some feedback on those, because that's really what the focus today was supposed to be about, is to what's happening elsewhere that speaks to these issues. And I'm not hearing that in today's, with all due respect, I'm not hearing that in today's conversations.
So first of all, I would like to say the two people that we had scheduled for, unfortunately, they couldn't meet.
Okay.
So, of course, we filled in what we needed to do.
Okay.
And hopefully that would be addressed at another time. But I just wanted to assure you that was the purpose. But because we were talking about affordable housing, low-income housing, we plugged some folks in today.
Thank you for that perspective.
All right,
but I'd love to get a response. Good.
In dealing with everyone that I'm trying to rehouse, a lot of them are not from here. So everything that I'm hearing is a total contradiction to what I know to be true. So in all these other cities and states, they say, we love Jacksonville because they have all these other programs that they can help us. But they don't know when you get here the struggles that you have to go through to go through these programs.
So what they're saying, they don't have programs there to help them.
Right. In other counties, they don't have public assistance where they could apply for an emergency housing voucher. They don't have rehab facilities where the people could get rehab. They don't have transitional facilities where someone can transition from homelessness to a stable
house. Well, we had a lot of conversation at the homeless workshop yesterday. I'd suggest you go back and take a look at all three of those, because we heard some very good opportunities that's happening in Miami, Minneapolis.
Yes, Miami.
Please take a look at those. Thank you.
I would say that one of the biggest impacts that I've seen outside of Jacksonville in the state of Florida is with the city of St. Pete and the transformative affordable housing policies that are taking place in Hillsborough County. City of St. Pete won an award for Florida Housing Coalition for putting 70% of their ARP funds towards affordable housing and solving that issue in their community. And I think that is a major first start, is to lead with your funding so that as you create policies and programs, that funding source is there to support them so that it goes beyond the conversation. Capital injection is by far going to be one of the biggest things that's going to move the needle. And I think that if we're intentional about addressing this issue, we have to be intentional about where we put our dollars.
Thank you.
Alex, any comment from you?
I will say that, so what Taka was talking about, we've actually had a pilot program we were working on with Sulzbacher, and we actually executed with the Tim Tebow Foundation, where Tim Tebow Foundation has a focus on human trafficking, and we actually housed four of their clients in one of our houses, and we worked out. The issue is with insurance, and there's a lot of hurdles. We worked through all of them, and we actually housed them through a master lease agreement with the foundation, and it's been working out really well. And we were actually running a pilot program. Is Cindy still here?
No.
I thought I saw her come in. With Sulzbacher Center, where we were going to do 10 houses, 10 JWB houses, through a master lease agreement for your exact type of clientele. And we'd love to. With Cindy, there was a voucher issue that it wasn't allowed, but we'd love to have that conversation. The concept was we would do that with 10 of our houses, prove it out, and then we could go to other landlords and say, hey, this is something that sounds scary on the front end, because you have people that have evictions or criminal history and don't have a source of income, but we got comfortable with it, and hey, we did it for 6 months and it worked, and now we can go out to the greater landlord community and make that pitch and have data to show them why it makes sense. So we'd love to be a part of that conversation. We've already built out the program. We just need to figure out a couple more of the details to make it work.
It's also a problem with the domestic violence sector. You have a lot of people who flee here from other places and people that are already local that are trying to flee their domestic situation. If you don't pass or meet the criteria, or they're just full, then where do you go? You're stuck sleeping in your car or looking over your shoulder every 5 minutes. They won't take certain types of groups of people at these places. But so far, I only know about the Hubbard House. And then you have Quigley House if you're not a Duval County resident. But where does that leave the people that walk up to Family Promise daily who are experiencing domestic violence or displacement for whatever, they don't meet criteria. All of them that are able-bodied work, but they just cannot afford the rent. They don't qualify for the programs. I have tenants that are in somewhere that I don't know where else to turn to them or where to tell them to turn because they have a pest infestation. They report it to the landlord or the property manager. They get nowhere. The maintenance request, they put the maintenance request in. They have nothing. Now you have an infestation. Who helps that? Can they go to the housing authority? What if they've gone? Now what? Where does the housing authority play into that?
And I think, and to also comment on the tenant bill of rights, I think that there's a lot of validity to a lot of those things. Like I said, I would want to be focused on making sure that it wasn't going to reduce supply, but you know, a notice on a high rent increase, like that seemed perfectly reasonable and helpful. So I think that a lot of the tenant bill of rights is a good idea. I'd love to help figure out how to get something like that.
And there are lots of rights for tenants and landlords as exemplified in the Florida statutes. I printed that out. There is something online that will advocate for the tenants. But it kind of goes both ways, but then on some things it kind of doesn't. But they have to, just like the landlord has to give them a certain amount of notice to leave or whatever, if you don't know, you just get scared and leave. But you do have rights. You just don't know. When you say, I don't know when my rent is due, I don't know when it's late, I don't know how much I have to pay when it's late, all that's in the lease agreement. And what I know is no one's going to let you live somewhere without giving you a lease. It's your responsibility. That's why it's called rights and responsibilities. It's your right to get these services, but it's also your responsibility to take some accountability for where you're living and how you're living. If you know you have to budget out stuff to make ends meet, you have to do that. You can't just say no one told you or I didn't know or... That can't be allowed because you signed your name on a line.
Yep.
I'd like to, before we move forward, is acknowledge Councilman Salem, who's here with us as well. And I think, too, Alex, by you being one of the largest, your company, one of the largest land rental and property managers, that is good for you to listen to what we've been listening to. And, you know, we could potentially come up with best practices as well, because I think it's important that, you know, we walk the walk and talk the talk and make sure that if there's something that we can do to help to improve and develop legislation or recommendations for reform. And, you know, we heard earlier in the audience as well, there's a young lady that, you know, she has a job, she has education, and now she's facing, you know, the possibility of not being in her apartment. And so I think for best practices purposes, that you could leave with that is, I guess, what I'm saying. And today was really, as he said, Councilman Boylan said, was supposed to really be about that, to kind of take what we've learned in the last few weeks and be able to come up with best practices in line with the SWOT analysis. Yep. And so I think today was a good day, even though, you know, God does everything for a reason. But I think this discussion is very healthy and it's durable. Yeah. You know, that's one thing. And, you know, we might do things a little bit differently as we put this whole anomaly together, that we can come up with something that we can be proud of and that is a solution base with the body of work that we all do.
Agreed. Yeah, and I think that, you know, I put on my slides the what I thought were the easy wins and the biggest takeaways, you know, from the SWOT analysis as far as things that would move the needle. So those would be, you know, from our perspective, the things that will move the needle. But I agree with a lot of other, you know, things that have been said today. So,
you know, as real people with real problems, you know, being affected by this, and only the legislative body or, you know, individuals like your company can really make a difference to the people. And I'm glad, you know, Taka wasn't even supposed to be here today, but I'm glad that she's here because she's the one that's working, you know, in the gutter, as we said, to help people. That most of the folks that are here every day, we're in the movement of helping and developing. But what do we do with the people that are down here? Because the folks who are living in affordable housing, eventually, if they can't meet
their rent, they're going to be down here. They're going to be the new homeless. Right. And then what do we do with the street homeless? So thank you for that. I'll let
I'm just and real quick on the homeless component, and I preach talk. You know, as you know, Ms. Gelman is the co-chair of that group. So we've heard this time and time again, the story. But bringing that information and perspective to the table certainly is relevant as it relates to this conversation.
Absolutely.
As well. So I do appreciate you being here. And also.
Absolutely. Councilman Sell.
Thank you, Councilwoman. I appreciate I'm sorry I was bouncing in and out. I am Councilman Boylan's vice chair, and this is my third of these this week. And the other job sometimes gets in the way of some of these things.
Really?
It really does. So, and this was one of those mornings. But I did have a comment. I was glad to hear Alex talk about maybe there's some common ground on some agreement on a Bill of Rights or for whatever you want to call that document. But what's not clear to me if there's a violation, you know, the tenant feels like their rent is going up quicker than the agreement says, who do they turn to? That's what's not clear to me in this whole process. Who is the enforcement mechanism? Is it the courts? Is the housing authority? Or who is that entity? Can someone tell me that?
The proposal asks that there be an Office of Housing Advocacy. So there would literally be a new position, a new office.
In the city.
David. That would be responsible for ensuring that the Bill of Rights was actually followed. And that would be the location that one would go to when they felt that there were violations of their rights.
Dr. Jaffe, presently, without that office, where does that person go to?
DPR, Department of Business and Public Regulations.
Yeah. Okay.
It's
do most of the do people know that?
No.
Okay. That's what I suspected.
Many don't even know their rights.
I understand.
That's one of the reasons why they need to be receiving a Bill of Rights on the signing of a lease, with also a list of the resources that they can access when they see that their rights are being violated, which would also include Jacksonville area legal aid.
And of course, there are rights on both ends, and I want to make sure that's clear.
Yeah.
You know, the renter has rights as well, and the tenant needs to follow those things clearly at the same time. Thank you, Councilwoman, for allowing me to speak.
Thank you. I saw someone standing at the podium. Do you still?
Yes, thank you. So I'll try to be very quick about this, because there's a lot of talks about tenant bill of rights.
Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Justin Garrett. I'm with the National Association of Residential Property Managers. There's been a lot of discussion about a tenant's bill of rights, and I think Ms. Chester has mentioned earlier she printed out the four statutes, which effectively is the bill of rights, and it is reciprocal for both owners and tenants. A quick Google search can get you that, and actually there's several sections to it. So section 2 is specific to the residential side, the housing side of it. And it's important to understand that, yes, there are rights for both sides because it's important for it to be balanced and equal. There was discussion about the tenant application and some discussion about the criminal history, et cetera, but we can't forget the fact that there is very strict fair housing guidelines that are enforced on any housing provider to treat absolutely everybody absolutely the same. And that's absolutely difficult to do. So there's something called disparate impact that has also been put out recently to where even though you have to treat everybody the same, you don't. Because if someone says, hey, I wasn't treated fairly, it's up to the housing provider to then create a process that they have to stick to then determine on a case-by-case basis if that applicant's history, et cetera, poses a threat to the neighbors or the community. And that's a very difficult thing to have to go through as well. So there's already things in place that maybe the public isn't massively aware of, but I think in this discussion it's important to understand the items that have already been put into play as a function to facilitate this. And one of the last things that I'd like to talk about and mirror Alex and what he's saying, we need to do something. And I think every property manager, business owner, landlord can agree to that. That's a very human, obvious thing. Something needs to take place. But what Alex has stated that I 100% align with and agree with is We need to be very careful not to have unintended consequences of any legislation or bills, et cetera, that would then take properties out of the market. And something that I have seen on this SWOT analysis, you know, it's talking about predatory landlords and investors. I think there's probably fewer of those than what might be understood. It's a business. It's a money-making function and mechanism, right? So if they are limited on the money-making abilities that they have, they're very likely to pull that property from this local area and take it somewhere where they don't have those restrictions on making the money, which will reduce the supply and exacerbate the issue and not make it any better. So want to help out and be a part of the process as a real estate professional dealing with rental properties and affordable housing. And again, just wanted to point out there are mechanisms already in place that haven't been discussed today that I do think absolutely should be part of the conversation moving forward. Thank you.
Justin, thank you so much. And, you know, I would like to see just from today, it seems like we have a lot of interest within the audience and continue the conversation with, you know, developers like and Alex and others in the community and Kalina, because I think if we can develop a comprehensive plan, then we can actually roll out a solution for our community. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. So as far as best practices
introduce
go,
yourself.
Oh,
please.
Yeah. My name is Maria, and I'm with the Theory of Change table. Just to point out, I'm coming as a community member, not as someone who has a vested interest in making money off of people for something that's supposed to be a human right. But as far as best interests, I really want to echo that we need the Tenants' Bill of Rights as just the very least that we can do. Mr. Salem was asking, like, who do we go to when the rent gets raised and, like, you can't pay it? No one. You just get evicted, and that's it. And the resources that are supposed to be there to help people, to advocate for people, don't work. And so, in the, like, we're not even asking right now, because we know in this political climate that it's very challenging to even ask to say, like, hey, let's put a cap on how we can raise rent. I think you guys should, because we're at such epidemic levels of, like, housing insecurity. But just what we're saying in this Tenant Bill of Rights is, please, let's protect renters. Let's try it for, so when people are looking for housing that's already in such short supply that they're not facing unnecessary barriers. I was just talking to a representative from Florida Immigrant Coalition, who said that when he's working with refugees, like people that are coming fleeing violence, political violence, whatever, their main obstacle in finding housing is that they have no credit history. And so all they want to do is come and be in this country and start a new life, and they can't because there's no credit history that they have. And so they're excluded from the housing market. And so we need protections for folks like that. That's all we're asking. And, you know, hopefully in the very near future, we can get to somewhere with our city council where we can have more discussions about more robust policy proposals to actually put a stop to, like, the housing crisis and the evictions. But for right now, the Tenant Bill of Rights does have some actionable protections and something that will just make renters feel like they have someone on their side. Because right now, there's no one on their side. It's just whatever the landlord wants. And, you know, we have so many preemptions. And we're even, you know, we're not even trying to go above these preemptions. We're just trying to give what the state will allow and let residents know that they have these protections so that they can exercise them. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else from the audience?
I do have a question for Alex. We're not going to have a debate, Alex. This is not firing line, point, counterpoint. But one of the things you've advocated is increasing the supply and the range of choices that renters and tenants have. Would that also include publicly owned housing that was protected from what is called a fair market rate? Would you include that in a range of options that would be available?
Absolutely. I mean, we're actually working with JHA right now on some concepts that could provide more publicly owned housing that would be protected. And I think there's ways to do that through just JHA owning the housing and having it be strictly, and there's public-private partnerships. But I think that's the only way you get to 30% AMI through those. So 100%, I would agree with that.
Okay. I think we have to consider that also as a potential recommendation. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Lindsay McLean. I'm with the First Coast Apartment Association. I want to echo some of the sentiments that have already been discussed about being wary of layering on additional levels that would potentially dry up development or make it more difficult for people to provide some of that affordable housing that we are so desperately in need of. But specifically speaking to unintended consequences, I noticed on the policy options, you did put mandatory requirements with a question mark. I do just want to make sure that there's some research done. There is House Bill 7103 that does require a local government to offset the cost to a developer when you require mandatory inclusionary zoning. So I just want to make sure that if that is something that's being presented to the council, there is fiscal requirement that would need to be figured out with that. So just want to make sure that that's something that's researched as well. And then, we've discussed a landlord registry several times. I also wanted to point out that it's actually preempted by DBPR under Chapter 509.327A. That is something that is required on a state-level regulation. So that's just also something to make sure that we're researching when we are discussing those topics, just as a potential unintended consequence. We don't want to make sure we're not stepping over. And then also, again, just to signify, it sounds like there is a lot of miscommunication on the protections that do exist for renters under the state landlord tenant statutes. There are things that do exist. It was brought up, some of the things that you can do to make sure that you are protected in your home. And so that sounds like maybe access to Jacksonville Legal Aid needs to be provided, contact information, a copy of the state statutes that do exist currently. Those seem like some easy, low-hanging fruit things that would be able to do to make sure that we're able to communicate what does exist for people currently, in the system. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I could help make clear, you can have a seat. This process, however messy it is, really the intent of these working groups is to bring these items to bear. So using the tenant bill of rights, if you will, as an example. So what happens next in this process? It invariably will end up as a recommendation coming out of this. I think that's pretty safe to say. And at some point then, a council member or council members will introduce an ordinance legislation that calls for a tenant bill of rights. And then when that happens, then there are a number of committees, and probably it would make sense for that that council person to host a couple public notice meetings, invite people to just talk about the benefit of that particular piece of legislation. So it doesn't end here, and that's one of the reasons why we won't collectively come up with a whole set of bill introductions here. That's going to happen in the typical legislative process. I recognize it makes it a journey, not a sprint, but that is the way this has to work in order for us to go through and understand and fully vet the ideas that come out of these working groups. So I just wanted to make people clear that if it shows up as a recommendation, good or bad, you for or against it, it's there will be opportunity to fully vet it individually as a piece of legislation. Thank you.
Beth?
I'm Beth Mixon, and I'm a little shorter than everybody else. I'm Beth Mixon. I have the privilege of working with TACA at Family Promise. I'm on the development side rather than the case management side, but part of my job is to listen, and I've heard lots of stories that have formed my opinions. And one about just following up with the unintended consequences and making this recommendation is suggesting people be referred to Jacksonville Legal Aid. And I know Jim has left, but one, we don't, as a city, fund Jacksonville Legal Aid. So if we are going to make that a recommendation, then we need to provide funding for them to have the resources to do that. I also know from my work on the Public Service Grant Council that it is difficult for tenants to know everything they're supposed to do, that we are friendly towards landlords for evictions, that there is a 3-day window for tenants to make the right steps to prevent an eviction. We also have to understand that people are under stress and trauma at that point, and that also making those right decisions, while we can say, yes, you should be making these decisions and know these steps, that you, when you're operating under trauma, whether it's because of rent eviction, a medical, or anything else, that it makes it more difficult to make those decisions in a rapid time. I also believe that tenants should have a right to counsel. Currently, they do not in the state of Florida. I think we need regulations regarding administration fees, waitlist fees for rental applications. They need to be reasonable instead of predatory. Frankly, I think charging to be on a wait list is predatory. Likewise, I will say that I think having tenants to have to pay for maintenance, to me, that's the advantage of renting, is that you're no longer responsible for the maintenance versus home ownership. I think we need incentives for landlords to accept vouchers, are a requirement that they have that to do so. And finally, I think we need to develop and maintain standard of quality housing. And I don't mean top-of-the-line appliances, granite counters, fine landscaping, but I will say in visiting families, there's many places I would not put my children in there. I would not have put a parent in there. I have had to jump to get out of the house because the steps are not there. I have seen places that are moldy and substandard. Housing should be sustainable and it should be safe to live in.
Thank you. Anyone else? Justin? Jesse, I mean. Thank you.
Jesse Spradley, Northeast Florida Builders Association, 6747 South Point Parkway. Thank you again for this opportunity. Great presentations by everyone here. Really showed you the whole scope of the challenge that y'all are facing as a group. But looking at these policy areas, I did thank you, Lindsay, for pointing out the mandatory requirements at the state level. Yes, you would have to offset any mandatory inclusionary zoning requirements, but incentives are always nice. Builders like to be incentivized more than required to do things and given options, which I love that we have those zoning approaches in on the regulatory approach, but I'd like to see you add the LDC requirements, our changes. I know we've heard from Ability Housing, FHC, even Bill Cunningsworth about possible land development code changes that could help, especially on the more affordable side with parking, landscape requirement buffers. So I'd love to see that added in while we're looking at the regulatory scope. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jason. Anyone else? We have about 10 minutes so left. Can I have, oh, I thought she was coming up. Are you coming up? Okay, go ahead.
Mine was just a clarification on the preemption comment on the landlord registry. And perhaps this is just a matter of terminology and what we're calling, but there are, I provided model language from Gainesville who has a landlord registry which requires anyone who is going to rent property to get a license from the city. And Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale have similar. So there, so it is not preempted in that sense. We already have several models from major Florida cities.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, Noel.
And just to add value relative to the, as Councilman Boylan pointed out earlier, that the focus here is best practices, understanding we have changes in agenda at times. The mere point is that that is the intent in the council working with the co-chairs and such. Speaking personally, that I have been, I am a former landlord, and I know that Virginia, in my case, when I lived up there, has the Virginia Tenant Landlord Act. They have a handbook, as they call it, and I know they updated in the last year or two to be more centric to tenant rights. So, for example, looking and being aware of these best practices will work with the co-chairs.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Me?
I do. With that, I don't know if Councilwoman Pittman would like to say anything. Let me just thank the panelists. I appreciate the insights. I appreciate people telling us the kind of experiences they've had, where they think we can make the most progress. And I also greatly appreciate the input of the members of this committee, the larger members of this committee, the people who attend and take the time to come to these meetings. If you have some ideas that are not reflected in the documents that I've distributed, with regard to recommendations, please give them to me, and we will add them to the information that we're putting together when we finally develop our report. But again, I'd like to thank all of you who've taken the time to both attend and share your perspective. Councilwoman Pittman.
Thank you. I think Taka would like to, and for all of you that are on the panel, just want to see if you'd like any, have any last comments. Taka, we'll start with you.
So just a couple of things. For the tenants that sign leases, just like when you go somewhere and you get a snippet of what's going on, there could be like a pamphlet or handbook or something, resources, so that they know. Because I can give them a lease that's 19 pages. I heard what you said about renting, and I signed on the dotted line to pay this, this, and that. But I didn't really read what all was in there to understand that I do have rights. It's a lot of people, landlords, that will put an eviction notice on the door, but that's not, you have 3 days to leave. You have 3 days to decide what you want to do. So it's not like you got to hurry up and get all your stuff and get out of there. If you do, you will be abandoning the property, and that is something that is not allowed, and they can hold you for that. So it's lots of things that can be done. They just have to be made aware so that they know. With Changing Homelessness, when we exit someone out of the program or graduate them, we do an exit interview with them, which basically sits down to tell them, or for them to tell us, as of right now, you've been stably housed for this long, what do you think your lease is? How long do you think your lease is? When it expires? When are you required to pay rent? Do you know when your rent is late? Who are you going to go to when something goes wrong? Like, it's about a 5 or 6 page exit interview, just so that when we release you into the universe, you know what your responsibilities are. And just to let them know as tenants, if something goes wrong, this is where you go. Like the DVPR, nobody knows about that. The first thing anybody tells a tenant is go to JALA. They don't even know what JALA is. They don't know to go. Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, they just don't know to go. You have to know the steps. But that's where it's rights and responsibilities. You can't just sign up to live somewhere and don't know what it takes to maintain that housing. And you can't blame the landlords if you broke the rules and have to move out, or something goes wrong and you have to move out. But in the same token, if 30 days is required for, and it's different clauses in here for if you are on a month-to-month lease, week-to-week lease, quarter-to-quarter lease, it's different things. But if I'm required to give you 30 days notice, and that's another thing people fail to realize, in life, you can't prosecute anyone if you don't have documentation. So I might have told the landlord verbally 10 times that I'm being infested by roaches or rats or whatever it is. If I didn't document it somewhere, if I don't have pictures of it somewhere, if I don't have a record that I told someone in authority, you have no leg to stand on. There has to be a story behind why you're going to withhold the rent. You can't just say, I'm withholding rent because my roof is falling in. When did the roof fall in? Well, you've been living in here for, what, 90 days and you didn't say anything about the roof? No one's going to believe it. We get it and I see it, but where is the documentation that will back you when you go to enact your rights as a tenant? Because you have rights. You don't have to immediately move out when somebody puts an eviction notice on. You don't have to immediately say, I'm not going to pay rent. You know, and for the lady here, we have two parts of Changing Homelessness. It's rapid rehousing and it's homelessness prevention. So she would fall in a category of homeless prevention. We don't want her to become homeless. What then is her recourse? Where can she go now? If she doesn't qualify for a voucher, or maybe at this point she will qualify for someone, but that's when you need private donors and other people to donate to places like Family Promise, so that when you call us, we only help family units. However, when you call us, we can help you stay in your house and help you at least for 30 more days where you can be a little bit more stable and find another place. You know what I mean? There's Fatherhood Pride that helps single dads if they have something, because most people won't help you. But there are programs out there that will help you and will help you stay housed and will help you get housed. You just got to know where to go. So like a cheat sheet to hand out with the lease, something that they can read and comprehend, because mm-hmm. the lease is a lot and it's a lot of legal jargon.
Right. Thank you so much. Ms. Shirley.
Sure. I say this has been an impactful day. It's a lot of information. But I would say that this terminology of affordable housing is one that's used very broadly. And as we can just see from this conversation today, there's many intricate categories that fall under affordable housing that all need a deep dive and a thorough evaluation of impacts to this community. One of the biggest areas that I think that is missing from this conversation is the policy discussion on what are the policies that are actually in play currently. What are the funding sources that fall under affordable housing? How have we utilized that funding? Is it moving the needle? How are we using the funding? Or do we need to be doing something different? And that is a very thorough evaluation that I think needs to be done here in the city of Jacksonville. We have more money now that falls in line with our ability to impact affordable housing than we've had probably in the last 10 years combined. And to move this needle and really move this conversation, it's going to take more than what we've been doing as we've always done it. And I know that some of the policies that you or recommendations you were hoping to get out of this conversation would be new, innovative things. But I think first we have to start with looking at what have we been doing, how have we been doing that, and then look to see what are those innovative things that we can bring to that scope once we know how we've been, have we been effectively using what we currently have. The last thing I would say is that there is a community voice here that I'm not sure has been participating or has been actively at this table, and that is the CHOTOs and the CDCs who have been commissioned in this community to be the community builders of their communities. And every single community has its own intricate challenges, and they should be addressed and approached in that manner that's going to be best for that community. And I don't think that we can achieve that by not having those voices actively at the table telling us what those challenges are and directly dealing with those challenges that they're presenting to us, that they're dealing with on a day-to-day basis, that aren't these overarching bucketed how do we create a policy for this whole broad category mm-hmm. type of approaches. And so I would really, really hope that from this is further dialogue directly with the people who have been commissioned to be the community builders in our community, and when they speak, empower them and support them in creating change in those communities. I would also say that you have an extensive housing staff that is very knowledgeable in this space, that works in this every day. Empower your housing department, your housing staff, your neighborhoods department to bring back those things that they are also hearing from the community that can be implemented. They go to the conferences, they're engaging with this professionals. Their voice is equally important in this conversation to make sure they're leading in those policy changes.
Okay. Thank you. Alex?
I'd just like to say thank you to all the council members and Dr. Jaffe for putting this together and all everyone that came and spoke. I do think that this feels different than past conversations we've had about affordable housing. I really do think that some great policy is going to come out of this. I think the only thing that I haven't directly addressed that I probably would like to speak on is just this concept about the financialization of real estate. And it being a bad thing, I think that, you know, every house that you lived in, a developer built and probably made money off of, the apartment complexes that were built in Riverside in the 1920s were built so that somebody could rent them out and make a return off of them. If we're trying to make it so that people are not making money off of housing, then you are going to dramatically decrease the supply. I do think that we need to make sure for things that are human needs like healthcare and housing and food, that there are regulations in place and policies in place to make it as equitable and open as possible so that people need a place to live. But if we're demonizing people making money off of real estate, then and not predatorily making money off of real estate, but just making money off of real estate, then that is going to end up, I think, in a very negative place where we are dramatically decreasing supply. So I think there's a big delineation between predatory practices and the fact that every place you've lived, every piece of food you've eaten, like in some way, money is made off of that, and that's what continues to keep, you know, the economy moving forward and these things being built and lived in. So.
Thank you. Noel, anything from the regional department? All right. Well, this concludes our meeting for today, and our next meeting is scheduled for November the 7th. Thank you so much. Don't forget to vote. Early voting started.